on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Monday, July 16th. I'm Chirag Mahajan, and you're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca. Good evening. It is 5:07, and time for another relatively full hour of independent news. Our headlines for today will be primarily international news, but we will go in depth into a couple of provincial and national headlines regarding the Canadian Parliament, as well as a Supreme Court ruling on Canada's ban on assisted suicide. All this plus your weekly health segment brought to you by our health team and your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now we shall start with our international headlines brought to you by Democracy Now!
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Syrian capital of Damascus is seeing some of its heaviest fighting to date since the uprising against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad erupted over a year ago. Heavy weaponry, including tanks and mortar fire, has reportedly been used in areas to the city's south. The intensified clashes have prompted the International Committee of the Red Cross to join the United Nations in describing the conflict in Syria as a civil war. The Red Cross had previously kept its assessment to a handful of flashpoint areas, but now says the violence is nationwide. The UN Observer mission, meanwhile, has confirmed heavy weaponry was used last week in the village of Tremsa, where pro-Assad forces were accused of massacring more than 100 civilians. UN spokesperson Sazen Ghasha announced the Observer's findings earlier today.
In this attack, there was use of heavy weapons on population centers. Our observers confirmed the use of direct and indirect weapons, including artillery, mortar shells, and small arms. And the accounts of 27 eyewitnesses that we interviewed, the consistent account, all indicated that the attack started at 5 o'clock in the morning via shelling, and then ground forces went in.
The Assad regime has denied carrying out a massacre in Tremsa, claiming it killed anti-government rebels. The UN Arab League peace envoy Kofi Annan is headed to Moscow for talks on a new Security Council response to the ongoing violence in Syria. Speaking during a visit to Lebanon, Deputy Secretary of State William Burns called for new pressure on the Assad regime.
We need to act now through a new United Nations Security Council resolution in New York, which carries consequences for the Syrian regime's continuing and increasingly violent non-compliance with its obligations. It is long past time to begin a democratic transition to a post-Assad Syria, to a future that reflects the legitimate aspirations of the brave and determined Syrian people.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has wrapped up her first visit to Egypt since the election of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi last month. Over the weekend, Clinton held separate talks with Morsi and the head of Egypt's Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, Hussein Tantawi. Clinton said she was in Egypt to support the country's democratic transition.
Democracy is hard. We have been at this for more than 236 years. And it requires dialogue and compromise and real politics. We are encouraged and we want to be helpful, But we know that it is not for the United States to decide. It is for the Egyptian people to decide.
Clinton faced a number of protests during his visit, with memories still fresh of Republic support for ousted Egyptian leader Hosni Mubarak when the uprising broke out last year. Her motorcade was pelted with projectiles as it headed to the city of Alexandria Saturday. In Cairo, former Guantanamo Bay prisoner Sami Abdulaziz took part in a protest against Clinton, calling for compensation for victims of U.S. torture.
The Americans have imprisoned me at Guantanamo for 4 years. They completely tortured me and destroyed me. The military court deemed me innocent of their accusations, and I have rights to ask after 4 years of torture.
Here in the United States, President Obama brought his reelection effort to the battleground state of Virginia over the weekend with a series of events. During his public remarks, Obama continued to focus on Romney's record at the helm of the private equity firm Bain Capital.
Yeah, Mr. Romney's got a different idea. You know, he invested in companies that have been called pioneers of outsourcing. I don't want a pioneer in outsourcing. I want some insourcing. I want to bring companies back.
Mitt Romney has faced new scrutiny over following last week's revelation he remained Bain's top executive 3 years longer than he has previously disclosed. Romney had maintained he left Bain in 1999 to run the Winter Olympics in Utah, but financial disclosures show he remained in control of Bain and earned a salary through 2002. The three-year period in question saw Bain shuttering a number of U.S. companies, leading to payoffs and the outsourcing of U.S. jobs. On Sunday, senior Romney advisor Ed Gillespie said Romney had, quote, retroactively retired from Bain in 2002, but effectively stepped down 3 years earlier. Gillespie also defended Romney's record on outsourcing U.S. jobs.
What he believes is that American companies and, private shareholders and CEOs should be free in our economy to make decisions. What we need to do as a policy is to make policies that make those decisions easier to say, I'm going to invest here in the United States. I'm not going to move my jobs overseas. The Obama policies are forcing jobs overseas.
Romney spokesperson Ed Gillespie on Meet the Press on Sunday. Meanwhile, in Baltimore, the Green Party wrapped up its convention with the nomination of its presidential candidate, the physician and activist Jill Stein, and her running mate, the anti-poverty leader, Sherry Hankala. Dr. Stein called her ticket a viable third-party challenge to corporate beholden Republicans and Democrats.
I strongly agree that grassroots democracy grows from the local community up. But at the same time, we have a state of emergency, I think, at the national level. And to silence the only hope of an opposition voice in this election when so much is at stake, I think would be just a terrible loss for the American people. There's no reason why Americans should have to walk into the voting booth in November and have only effectively two Wall Street-sponsored choices.
We'll have more from the Green Party convention with the keynote address of Gar Alperovitz later in the broadcast. A number of major banks are facing at least two criminal probes in the U.S. over a major interest rate fixing scandal that's already led to fines against the banking giant Barclays. Last month, Barclays was fined $443 million by U.S. and British authorities for manipulating the London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR, which provides the basis for rates on trillions of dollars in transactions across the globe. The manipulation meant millions of borrowers paid the wrong amount on their loans. The Justice Department has now confirmed its criminal division is putting together cases against several large firms and their staffers for taking part in the rate fixing. Meanwhile, the Attorneys General of New York and Connecticut have announced they've been conducting a probe of the rate manipulation for the past 6 months. All told, a slew of civil and criminal cases could cost the financial sector tens of billions of dollars. The Midwest continues to endure its worst drought in over a decade amidst a spate of extreme weather nationwide. Government statistics show about 63% of U.S. land is suffering moderate to extreme drought. Corn producers in the Midwest are struggling to keep their crops from dying in a season that initially had been expected to yield a record harvest. The Department of Agriculture has deemed over 1,000 counties in 26 states to be natural disaster areas, the highest such declaration ever. Farm Service Agency head Philip Ayers warned of widespread devastation to crops in the Midwest.
We're approaching 1988 standards for a drought. This is the main area of the United States where all the crops are grown. Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Missouri, Nebraska. We grow most of the corn and soybeans in the United States, and this is right where the drought is centered this time. We're all, in Missouri at least, we're all D2 to D3, and we're approaching D3 in the D2 areas. So it's very serious.
For our coverage of extreme weather's links to global warming, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. The New York Times has revealed the Food and Drug Administration conducted an extensive spying campaign against its own scientists. The spying began after the scientists warned the FDA had faultily approved medical imaging devices that endangered patients with high levels of radiation. The spying operation led the agency to monitor the scientists' computers at work and at home, copying emails and thumb drives, and even monitoring individual messages line by line as they were being composed in real time. In a statement, the National Whistleblower Center said, quote, the conduct by FDA managers designed to undermine a group of doctors and scientists who reported significant health and safety violations is deplorable. We hope that the revelations will mark a turning point in the battle to stop the retaliatory surveillance of whistleblowers who risk their careers to report misconduct, they said. The Justice Department has dropped its effort to halt Florida's controversial voter purge through the use of a law enforcement database. The federal government had tried to stop Florida from using the database to challenge the right to vote of residents suspected of being non-U.S. citizens, but a Florida judge upheld the purge earlier this month. Under a deal with government officials, Florida will only be able to challenge voters who carry a number of identifier commonly assigned to foreign workers in the United States. The agreement will prevent Florida from obtaining information based solely on the name or birth date of a suspected non-citizen. And the New York judge and former political activist Gustin Reichbach has died at the age of 65 after a lengthy bout with pancreatic cancer. Reichbach was a leading figure in Students for a Democratic Society at Columbia University in the 60s before going on to become a New York State Supreme Court judge in Brooklyn. Reichbach helped lead the notorious 1968 Columbia student strike. Appearing on Democracy Now! To discuss the strike's 40th anniversary, Gus Reichbach reflected on the historic protest.
There was some transcendent issues involved. We came together, Tom talked about the powerlessness that people felt, the powerlessness about being able to stop the war, the powerlessness in confronting an institution that had a incredibly paternalistic and controlling aspect to it. So part of this coming together and this really a spontaneous coming together was because we thought in some small way that we could be agents or wanted to be agents in the course of history. And we shared this electric moment where collectively all our hearts were touched by a certain passion and fire.
That was Judge Gustin Reichbach. 40 years ago, he was one of the leaders of the student strike at Columbia. His most recent piece in the New York Times appeared as an op-ed, an article about why he used medical marijuana to help deal with the pain of pancreatic cancer. He died this weekend. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's broadcast.
And thank you to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! For those international headlines. We are now going to go back to Democracy Now! For their further in-depth discussion about Syria and the United Nations and the Arab League envoy Kofi Annan and his meetings with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Amy Goodman will be talking to Rafif Jujati, who is an English language spokesperson for the Syria Local Coordination Committees.
Amy Goodman. We begin today's show with Syria, where UN and Arab League envoy Kofi Annan met today with President Bashar al-Assad in the midst of worsening violence. Syria's 16-month conflict has so far claimed more than 15,000 lives. Annan said today's last-ditch attempt to salvage a peace effort ended with an agreement on how to end the violence, but he did not disclose details. Earlier, he acknowledged his six-point peace plan had failed to halt the fighting between anti-government forces and the Assad regime. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon warned Sunday the conflict has taken a turn for the worse.
The situation on the ground has deteriorated dramatically and has become more militarized. Appalling violations of human rights continue to take place, and at least 1.5 million people are in need of urgent humanitarian need.
Annan's arrival in Syria comes as dozens more were reportedly killed across the country, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton warned that time is running out to save Syria from a, quote, catastrophic assault.
The future, to me, should be abundantly clear to those who support the Assad regime. The days are numbered, and the sooner there can be an end to the violence and a beginning of a political transition process, not only will fewer people die, but there's a chance to save the Syrian state from a catastrophic assault that would be very dangerous, not only to Syria, but to the region.
Earlier, at an International Friends of Syria gathering in Paris, Clinton pressed for greater sanctions against the Assad regime, invoking the threat of Chapter 7 under the UN Charter, which includes measures ranging from economic embargoes to military force. Meanwhile, in a rare television interview with the German public broadcaster ARD aired Sunday, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad was asked about the role of the United States and accused the country of complicity in the violence.
It's part of the conflict. They give, they offer the umbrella and political support to those gangs to create destability or to destabilize Syria.
You say the United States is politically supporting the rebels. Yes. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly.
And you say these rebels, whom you call terrorists, kill civilians. This means you are accusing the American government of being at least partly responsible for the killing of innocent Syrian civilians. Is that correct?
Of course, exactly. As long as you offer any kind of support to terrorists, you are a partner. Whether you send them armament or money or public support, political support in the United Nations, anywhere, any kind of support, this is implication.
President Bashar al-Assad, during this rare interview with German public broadcaster ARD, the interview came as the regime suffered its highest level defection to date. On Thursday, Syrian General Manaf Tias, a member of Assad's inner circle, fled to Turkey, reportedly over his anger at the Syrian government's killing of civilians. Well, for more, we're going to Washington, D.C., to be joined by Rafif Jujati, the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, a network of activists throughout the country. Let's start off with that last point, the significance of this latest high-level defection. Rafif.
Sure. It's significant in that it is very high level. Manaf Atlas is a close personal friend of the Assad family. He was a very close friend of the deceased Bashar al-Assad and continued the friendship with Bashar. Manaf Atlas's defection also signals the wave of high level defections that are taking place with increasing rapidity.
Talk about the situation overall right now in Syria. Estimates of what, 15,000 dead?
Sure, there are some 15,000 dead. There are some 200,000 people in prison. We have more than 1.5 million displaced people, internally displaced people, who are at risk of starvation. We have disaster cities all around the country, and we have some entire villages and towns that have been obliterated. So it's very dire indeed. The humanitarian situation is probably the most critical we've ever seen.
In this rare TV interview that President Assad did with the German public broadcaster ARD, Assad was asked whether he was scared of meeting the same fate as former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak or Libya's Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. This was his response.
If I want to describe two different situations you're talking about, describing what happened to al-Qaddafi, this is savage. This is crime. Whatever he did, whatever he was, nobody in the world can accept what happened to kill somebody like this. What happened to Mubarak is different. It's a trial. Any citizen, when he watches a trial on TV, he would think that I don't want to be in that position. So the answer is don't do like them, don't do like him. But to compare or to be scared, you have to. To be scared, you have to compare. Do we have something in common? No, it's a completely different situation. What's happening in Egypt is different from what's happening in Syria. The historical context is different. The social fabric is different. And our policy was always different. So what's in common? You cannot compare.
That's Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Rafif, your response to that point, and also the one he raised earlier, that the U.S. is funding the opposition.
His point that you cannot compare Libya and Egypt to Syria, he's partially right. He has committed far more atrocities, we believe, than Muammar Gaddafi managed to do, or that Hosni Mubarak managed to do. The other thing is that Muammar Gaddafi and Hosni Mubarak did not inherit power from their fathers. So there is a little bit of a different situation. Now, what has happened to Gaddafi and what has happened to Mubarak may very well be the fate Assad suffers. He may suffer a worse fate. We are pushing for full prosecution in the International Criminal Court, but you never know if the Syrian people, the Syrian street, doesn't take matters into its own hands.
And his point about the United States and its involvement in supporting the opposition, or the terrorists, as Assad calls them.
Well, the United States has been very vocal in pledging support to the opposition. They are pledging non-lethal aid. They're pledging an increase in humanitarian assistance to help the people suffering in Syria. I don't know that this makes the United States a terrorist country. In fact, Assad has blamed almost everybody in the world but himself. We have to keep in mind that he is responsible for the massacres. He is responsible for the current chaos in Syria.
In the German interview that he did this weekend, Bashar al-Assad said most of the people being killed in the country are sympathetic to his regime.
If you want to know who killed, you have first to know who has been killed. We cannot tell about the criminal without knowing about the victims. Those victims that you're talking about, the majority of them are government supporters. So how can you be the criminal and the victim at the same time? The majority are people who support the government, and large part of the others are innocent people who's been killed by different groups in Syria.
President Assad went on to explain who he holds responsible for the Houla massacre in May, where, according to the United Nations, 108 people were killed, including 34 women and 49 children.
Gangs came in hundreds from outside the city, not from inside the city, and they attacked the city, and they attacked the law enforcement forces unit inside the city, and then they killed many families, and as you mentioned, children and women. And actually, those families that's been killed, they are government supporters, not opposition.
Rafif Shoshati, your response.
I'm not sure if Bashar al-Assad is simply experiencing a lapse in reality, or if this is just part of a misinformation or disinformation campaign. The bottom line is that the majority of the country is engaged in a popular revolution for freedom, for democracy, for dignity. And he cannot take that away with a few simple words. We have mountains of evidence indicating that his armed forces have been engaged in systematic torture, rampant detentions, massacres across the country. When we talk about the Houla massacre specifically, he does not mention that his regime forces had surrounded the area for days and were shelling it. Armed opposition elements could not have penetrated if they'd wanted to. He doesn't mention the ongoing 30-day shelling of additional parts of Homs. So I think he perhaps has lost touch with reality and maybe doesn't know what's actually happening in his country.
In May of this year, Democracy Now! Spoke to Charles Glass, the award-winning journalist specializing in the Middle East, who had just returned from Syria. He said most of the people he spoke to there were opposed to military intervention.
They all remember what happened when the United States invaded Iraq, and they don't want that kind of chaos. They don't want a total destruction of the state, and then a prolonged civil war with the ethnic and sectarian cleansings that they saw in Iraq. Remember, they received over 2 million refugees from Iraq who were fleeing the chaos that came after the American invasion. And they don't want to be subject to that themselves. I mean, surely those who use the massacre as a justification to call for Western airstrikes or Western invasion should think that actually this massacre should be a reminder of what could happen not only without an invasion, but because of an invasion.
That's journalist Charles Glass. Refusia, to your response.
So I really think that no Syrian wants military intervention simply for the sake of military intervention. We have been pushing along the lines of civil disobedience, creative nonviolence, supporting the sanctions, engaging in general strikes across the country. In fact, we had some very successful ones just yesterday across the whole country. But the Assad regime is one that only knows violence. And it appears that Assad and his cronies will only go through violence. So we have to look at the options available to us and how to overthrow the government.
What about what's happening right now? What about Kofi Annan, the UN and Arab League envoy to Syria, meeting with Assad today?
Kofi Annan, by his own admission, has tendered a failed peace plan, and apparently he has reached some agreement with Bashar al-Assad on a political solution, but they've not communicated what that is. What I do know is there's a lot of talk of a peaceful transition, and there's some talk about power sharing. And I can tell you that the power sharing scenario is most likely totally unacceptable to the Syrian street. Any sort of dialogue with the regime is tantamount to negotiating with one's executioner, and I believe that is entirely unacceptable.
What have you heard about the latest news of security forces shelling parts of Deir ez-Zor, Daraa, Homs, Aleppo, and Damascus, reports of more than 100 people killed, mainly civilian?
Yes, this happens every day. This is part of what we wake up to. It's what we go to sleep with. The daily killings are routine for the Assad regime. You name a city, it is either being shelled or the people who are going out in demonstrations are being shot at. This is daily.
So right now, in terms of the Syrian activists that you've been communicating across Syria and also outside of the country, what do you demand at this point, Rafif?
Well, many of us are demanding increased sanctions, enforceable sanctions. We're demanding more pressure on Russia to halt arms shipments to Syria, the very weapons that are killing civilians. We are demanding that the UN step up to the plate, that Kofi Annan stop reassuring us with his hopes for a better future and realize that hope is not a strategy. If we are going to move to any sort of negotiated peace plan or any sort of transitional framework, we want to make sure there are mechanisms to enforce a ceasefire. Those are the kinds of things we're demanding.
Where do you see President Assad going and his family?
I would like to think that we will proceed with full prosecution in the International Criminal Court. I think the longer this issue goes on and the more violence he commits, the more likely he will wish to have a fate such as Gaddafi's.
Rafif Joyjati, I want to thank you for being with us, English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, a network of activists throughout Syria. She's based in Washington, D.C. This is Democracy Now! When we come back.
And thank you to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! For that very engaging interview with Rafif Joyjati, who is an English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, which is a network of activists throughout America. And those are your international headlines and the in-depth coverage on Syria here on News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your weekday weather forecast as well as your in-depth provincial headlines.
Frontrunner's 8th Annual Pride Run and Walk kicks off Pride Week, Saturday, July 28th, 2012. This 10-kilometer run, 4-kilometer walk in Stanley Park raises money for local charity Out in Schools, bringing awareness and fighting bullying and homophobia in primary and secondary schools in Canada. Register as a team or individual for this fabulous event with incredible prizes for top finishers and the largest, fastest, and best-dressed teams. Join MLAs and all of your friends at the largest Pride Run and Walk ever. Support a great cause and have a blast. For more information or to register, visit www.vancouverfrontrunners.org. Queer FM Vancouver Reloaded and CITR 101.9 FM are proud media partners and supporters of the Pride Run and Walk.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
And welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to News 101. We are broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia to Vancouver and online at CITR.ca. Don't forget, you can listen to our past interviews and health segments on our website, CITR.ca/news. We now have your local weather forecast for the week, brought to you by Phil from the UBC Storm Club. Hi, Phil.
Hi, CJ. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good evening, listeners. So, from what the models are showing right now, a pretty interesting week lies ahead of us. Interesting in the sense that there will be a good variety of weather. The big picture is Vancouver is currently sandwiched, if you will, between two quasi-stationary pressure centers. A low to the north, situated just north of Yukon, and a high to the east, hovering over the Pacific Ocean. So the two centers being quasi-stationary don't really move if you view them on a coordinate plane, but they are rotating. And during that process, they are sometimes expanding, sometimes compressing, and even on occasion, an arm breaks off or something and forms like an independent cell. In summary, the two pressure centers, while they're not moving, they're like constantly asserting influences on the narrow band of air between them. Yes, that's us, Vancouver. So we're going to get some really quick changes from like dynamic to calm or vice versa overnight thanks to that. That said, in all that randomness, one weather feature we can pick out and kind of identify is a mini low that's going to slip through between the two centers on Wednesday. So we're going to see some rain on Wednesday and maybe Thursday as well, depending on how fast that moves over us. Awesome. So, yeah, now here's your 5-day weekday weather summary for Vancouver. Tonight, clear skies, low of 17. Tuesday, sunny. High of 24, 29 inland, UV index 8 or very high. Sorry. Tuesday, night, a few clouds, increasing cloudiness before morning, low of 17. Wednesday, cloudy with a 40% chance of showers, mini low, high of 21. Thursday, also cloudy with 40% chance of showers, low of 15, high of 21. Friday, a mix of sun and cloud with 40% chance of showers, high of 14, high of 21. All right, so that's your weekday weather summary, courtesy of Environment Canada. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil, and I'm a member of the UBC Storm Club. Back to you, CJ.
Thank you, Phil. That sounds good, whatever it is. Looking forward to your next one.
Yeah, thanks.
Cheers.
See you.
And that was Phil with your weekday weather forecast. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. It is now time for your weekly health segment brought to you by our health team, Dietetics Intuition. This week, they are going to talk about fiber.
Hi, everyone. This is Dietetic Intuition for July 16th. So the sun is out, and we know what that means. July, summer, lots of fresh fruit and produce coming out of BC. And a lot of fruits and vegetables, as we know, contain lots of fiber, which is going to be the topic that I'm talking about today. I'm going to be talking about what exactly is fiber, the different types, and why it's important for your overall health, interesting health facts, and also really useful pointers from the Dietitians of Canada website to help you reach your goal of 38 grams a day for men and 25 grams a day for women. So we'll get started with what is fiber. Well, dietary fiber, specifically called dietary fiber, consists of naturally occurring plant materials that your body cannot digest, and these are found in whole grains, cereals, beans, lentils, fruits, and vegetables. There's another type called functional fiber, and these are manufactured or synthetic plant and animal materials that your body cannot digest. For example, you've heard of psyllium fiber, and they promote bowel regularity and control blood cholesterol and blood sugar levels. So why is fiber important for overall health? Well, it's linked with reducing your risk of heart disease, diabetes, obesity, and certain types of cancer. High fiber diets also provide bulk, and they make you feel fuller for longer. And people who have high fiber diets tend to have lower body weights, and many businesses have been taking advantage of this fact about fiber and how it makes you feel fuller longer. For example, PGX is a supplement that is mainly fiber that's dissolved in water, and it makes people feel fuller longer, and they eat less as a result. And apparently have been having some success about people losing weight through this. But, you know, you can do this naturally. You can include at least 6 servings of whole grain products a day, or at least eat at least 7 servings of vegetables and fruit a day. It's an easy way to increase your fiber and make yourself feel fuller for longer. And, you know, it's a little less expensive, I believe, especially if you buy local and fresh produce. We have a huge list here of what's available right now, what's in season for July specifically, and these growing seasons for the fruits and vegetables I'm about to mention can span a few months, either before or after. But just to name a few, apricots, chard, cherries, cucumber, green beans, kale, love kale, cauliflower and carrots. They're all in season out of BC, so if you're a big fan of the 100-mile diet, there you go. And so, again, how can we add more fiber to our diet, and what do we need to make sure we do? Well, you need to make sure that the more fiber you introduce, do it slowly, or else you're going to get a little bit of stomach upset, and drink lots of fluids along with it. And this is very important because fiber attracts water, and it can all wind up in a big clump in your digestive tract and create problems if you don't drink enough water per day. So back to what we need per day, 25 grams a day for women and 38 grams a day for men. And if you're wondering what exactly is a high fiber food, a high fiber food is a food that contains 5 or more grams of fiber per serving. So when you look at your labels, it's really important to check out the labels of, say, a loaf of bread. If it doesn't have more than 5 grams of fiber per serving, which is usually about 1 slice, then it's not high fiber. Easier ways to include fiber into your diet, or just don't peel your vegetables such as apples. Keep the peel on, especially potatoes as well. Add toasted nuts or sesame seeds or sunflower or pumpkin seeds to salads. And, for example, you can add tablespoons of bran, flax seed, fruit, or high-fiber cereal to your regular cereal in the morning. And basically eat fruit instead of drinking juice. Always include water, of course, in your diet, along with all these extra fiber introductions into your body. And that's about all we have for you today. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at CITR Health and on Facebook, Dietetic Intuition. And I will check in with you next Monday. Until next time, stay happy and healthy, Vancouver.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. That was your Dying Tuition Intuition segment brought to you by Jessica. And next on News 101, we will go to Free Speech Radio News on to hear a segment about the current state of Mexico.
In Mexico City, thousands continue to protest over the weekend against President-elect Enrique Peña Nieto. This follows charges of vote buying and election irregularities and a challenge filed with the electoral court by leftist opponent Andres Manuel López Obrador. As the controversy continues, the Real News Network's Paul Jay spoke to professor and poet James Cockcroft, author of Mexico's Revolution, Then and Now.
So first of all, give us the basic facts of what happened in the election and what is the controversy? Why is it being so challenged?
The election has been challenged for many months now because the mass media in Mexico, led by Televisa, the big TV monopoly, or part of a duopoly actually, was coming out in favor constantly for one candidate, the candidate who supposedly triumphed in the July 1 presidential election, Peña Nieto. And it was broadcasting false news about his main contender from the left center, López Obrador, and telling lies about López Obrador and half-truths about the candidate that it supported, Peña Nieto, from the PRI, the former longest ruling political party in the world until its replacement in a fairly democratic election in the year 2000 by a more conservative party. And that conservative party's been in power for the last 12 years and has continued to guide Mexico down to the abyss of economic failure and poverty and more violence, etc.
The difference in votes is something like about the number of votes that they accuse have been bought. Is that right?
Yeah, well, actually, even they only won by 3 million votes, but they're accused of having purchased 5 million votes.
Right. Will the Mexican elite, which has done so well with this neoliberal economics and free trade and, you know, some of the richest billionaires in the world have emerged in Mexico. Are they going to allow any legal process that would bring in López Obrador, who at least in terms of his campaign promises, wants an alternative to this kind of neoliberal economics?
Yeah, he's running against neoliberal economics, and it's not even a socialist program or anything of the kind. It's just a sort of moderate capitalism that a more humane capitalism that he's advocating, and of course protection of the nation's national resources, particularly oil, most of which has already been delivered indirectly to the U.S. and other foreign companies. So he's sort of a nationalist, moderate centrist, left of center, but the elites, as you say, will not allow him in. And so that's why in the previous presidential election that he ran in 6 years ago, López Obrador won by everyone's testimony, and it's been documented, including in my new book, Mexico's Revolution Then and Now. And yet he was not allowed to take office. Calderón came in from the conservative PAN party and unleashed the military on the people to repress any social movements or protests. Now, back in 2006... of course, in the name of fighting narco gangs, but it's really to repress the social movements. Back in 2006, during that stealing of the election, the Mexicans occupied the main streets of Mexico City, Paseo de la Reforma, right down to the Zócalo, the main plaza, for 3 months, occupied the streets and camped out and protested this fraud. And now they're not doing that this year. López Obrador said, don't tie up traffic, don't do that. We're going to go through the courts and so on. That's what he's doing now. Right. But the people are ignoring him and going out on the streets anyway, and led in great part by this student movement that's formed alliances with those very worker and peasant movements that Peña Nieto repressed 4 years ago in the state of Mexico when the president-elect, so-called Peña Nieto, was governor at that time. So it's formed alliances with working class people and with gay and lesbian people, And with oppressed peoples in general, any peoples with complaints.
Elaborate a little bit more why you're calling this a phony narco war.
Well, it turns out, according to the UN Commission Against Drugs and Crime, that the vast majority of money in the narco traffic is laundered by the six largest U.S. banks. And the amount of money they laundered in 2008, when so many of the major banks collapsed, was enough to bail them out. But the narco trafficking is fundamental not only to the banks and therefore the survival of the U.S. economy, but to U.S. foreign policy, which uses the phony wars against narco trafficking to destabilize countries and justify the creation of military bases in those countries, okay, as it did in Colombia in the last 30 years and is beginning to do in Mexico, particularly in the last six years. Don't forget, narco trafficking is the second biggest liquid capital flow going on in world trade and world economics.
Right. Now, is Obrador considered a serious threat to all of this, including the narco trafficking?
Lopez Obrador is considered a serious threat in Washington. Absolutely. Absolutely. Even though he's guaranteed foreign investments and reassured foreign capital, he is considered a serious threat.
That was political scientist James Cockcroft, author of Mexico's Revolution, Then and Now. To watch the full video of this interview, go to therealnews.com. Demonstrations continue in Haiti, where many people remain without housing 2.5 years after the earthquake. Residents from the neighborhood of Jalousie near Pétionville marched after the government announced plans to demolish their homes to build a flood protection project. According to the International Organization for Migration, nearly 400,000 Haitians still do not have a permanent home, and residents of the tent camps have reported gender violence, poor sanitation, and forced evictions. For more, we're joined by Susana Ferreira. She's a freelance journalist based in Port-au-Prince, and she joins us by mobile phone. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
Protesters have drawn attention to a particular area south of the capital and the housing situation there. What is this area, and what are conditions like there?
The people protesting today live in an area called Jalousie, and it is just nestled on the side of a mountain right by a fairly well-off suburb just south of Port-au-Prince called Pétionville. It's a very densely packed area. There are small concrete houses and structures basically stacked one on top of the other throughout the mountainside. There's another settlement right next to it called Mourne-l'Hôpital. And this is the third protest, I believe, that residents of this zone have had regarding a plan that's been announced to demolish their homes, basically, and relocate them.
And at this point, is it clear where those residents would go and what the timeline is on a demolition plan?
There's now talks of moving people to either Mont-Cabri, which is just east of the capital, where a number of houses have been set up. They've been built by a Dominican company, and they're just sitting empty there in rows, or moving them south to Gressier, to a small community, just maybe a half hour to an hour south of Port-au-Prince. Nothing has happened yet, and I think that's in part what I'm being told is that's in part why people are protesting today. They're waiting for news. They're not being told. They're not being told whether their homes are going to be destroyed and whether they're going to be uprooted. For some of those people, it'll be the second time or maybe even third time being uprooted since the earthquake.
Now, amid this confusion about what exactly the government's plans are or where people in this particular place would go, the government of President Michel Martelly has pointed to an overall program titled the 16-6. They say 30,000 residents of six large camps would be settled to original, repaired 16 neighborhoods. How extensive is that program, and what's the status of that program now?
I went to check on one of the bigger areas for 16-6 the other day, which is Chamamaz, right in front of the National Palace, and there were just a few tents left of all of the many tents that had covered that area, that camp before, or several camps, I guess. And I'm being told that today the very last family is leaving. I'm not sure under what conditions, but apparently they've found a place to live. On paper, 16-6 is a great program. And as far as I know, it's still continuing, but it's really not tackling the majority of the camp population.
And that number, as we noted earlier, according to UN figures, nearly 400,000 Haitians living in temporary camps more than 2.5 years after the earthquake. You've also reported on an area, a different area north of Port-au-Prince called Titanien. It's known for having a large cemetery, and it's where people have struggled to build temporary housing. At the time, and this was in January on the anniversary of the earthquake, and it was published in Time magazine, you quoted Haiti's director of public works saying that reconstruction is being carried out as though the earthquake never happened. And he said this temporary housing, it could be causing long-term problems in the country. Where does this rebuilding effort on a broader scale, where does it stand now?
Reconstruction is being carried out for the most part as though the earthquake never happened. People are moving to areas like Jalousie and like Mont-Lopitan, but they're also moving in greater numbers, or in great numbers, I should say, to places like Titania, the place that I wrote about in Time magazine in January, as people are being evicted from their camps or pushed out for other reasons because there aren't any services or because life has become unbearable there. They're moving to these places and pitching tents and in many cases trying to set up more permanent structures in areas where there is no water, where there are floodplains, where they're near deforested mountainsides, where landslides can come and damage their homes and even kill them or injure them. We're out of rainy season for the moment, but we are in the middle of cyclone season, which will continue until October. So that is a major concern. A great number of people died in April with the rains, with flooding. So this is something that should be on people's minds as they're rebuilding. But not only that, it should be on the authorities' minds as they're watching a lot of this auto reconstruction, as they're watching people move to these places and construct with the same shoddy materials and practices that killed them 2.5 years ago.
That's Susana Ferreira. She's a freelance journalist in Port-au-Prince. She joined us to discuss the housing crisis in Haiti.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
This month in Discorder, check out part 2 of our Summer Festival preview, which indulges you in the folky, the hippie, the eclectic, and the electronic. Discorder sits down with Hot Panda to talk about things like hot sauce, writing food blogs, and the ultimate battle for panda greatness. We also talk with the V Vecker Ensemble, who are the Captain Planet of Vancouver indie music. We talk with Ryan Smith of Green Burrito Records of the value of cassette tapes, and experience Sasquatch Music Festival through the eyes of Discorder. Don't forget to check out our regular columns like Filmstrip, where we review the film Better Than Something. Check out our events calendar for all the greatest upcoming shows, and our art project focusing on the work of Aaron Moran. You'll find the greatest in both recorded and live music in our Under Review and Real Life Action sections. All this and more in the July issue of Discorder, that magazine from CITR, on stands now.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
And you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. And that is your program for today, July 16th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan, and today's show was produced by me. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for So Throats Clapping Hands with your host, Robert, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.